Good morning. This is Mickey Moran for the second part of our podcast called Getting the Most Out of Your IEP. So a few follow-up ideas from episode one. In part one, we discussed the need for creating an agenda as good practice. And a part of that process of creating the agenda, it's very helpful and almost essential that you be able to identify what you want the school to do. Sometimes parents struggle with knowing what to ask for or what their child needs. That is one reason to consult an attorney or outside professional to help you come up with that list of essential things to get for your child as part of the IEP process. I urge everybody to do this in writing as a good exercise, and it's important because I think it also helps the school listen more effectively. Keep your points simple and straightforward. Again, putting your request in writing helps you keep on task and memorializes your request. In the meeting, stay focused and be respectful. So I need to say a few words about recording meetings. I'm asked this question often, and my answer is to advise my clients not to record the IEP meeting. Other professionals feel differently. There's not consensus on this. There are a few reasons I've taken this position over the years. The most important one is if you want people to freeze up and quit talking and not discuss what's going on, you'll end up having people almost be mute when you're recording everything they're saying. That instantly shuts down dialogue, which I think is really an important piece of the IEP meeting. Recordings are rarely, if ever, usable after the meeting, and generally school districts bristle, and it will build more ill will and with very little upside as a result of it. So that's my editorial on recording. Parents are often confused about the decision-making in the process in the IEP meetings. Parents often believe that if they don't agree with the school, the proposed IEP can't be implemented or the placement change can't happen. This is, for the most part, incorrect. Parents and school district personnel do disagree. In fact, in my opinion, the process is designed in some ways to make disagreement inevitable. School districts are required to provide benefit. Parents always, and I hope always, want to maximize their child's potential. So let's talk about what the standard is. In March 2017, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a decision in Andrew F. versus Douglas County School District that extended the court's prior interpretation of the IEP team's duty in determining what a FAPE is, or a Free Appropriate Public Education, under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Improvement Act, or IDEA 2004. The team's duty, and that's including the parents, is to develop an IEP that will offer FAPE in the least restrictive environment for the student with a disability. What the court said is this: a child's IEP need not aim for grade level advancement if that is not a reasonable prospect, but that child's educational program must be appropriately ambitious in light of his circumstances. Every child should have the chance to meet challenging objectives. It cannot be right that the IDEA generally contemplates grade level advancement for children with disabilities who are fully integrated in the regular classroom, but is satisfied with barely more than de minimis progress for children who are not. Importantly, the decision gave deference to school officials, that is, team members, setting the expectation that school officials will apply their expertise and judgment in making decisions. The court's idea was that by the time a dispute reaches a court, which is the federal district court typically, the school officials will have had their chance to present their appropriately ambitious plan. So the NDREF standard extends the Rowley standard and applies to all students, regardless of their disability. To meet its substantive obligation under the IDEA, a school must offer an IEP reasonably calculated to enable a child to make progress appropriate in light of the child's circumstances. So what is the standard? The school needs to conduct complete, thorough, and meaningful assessments that include observations in multiple settings, as well as a thoughtful analysis of the student's needs. Assessment drives the IEP. The team, including the parents, need to develop IEP goals that are appropriately ambitious based on the student's unique circumstances. The same IEP goal should never be written over and over. Progress reporting is required. If the student is not making progress, the IEP team should reconvene and address the lack of progress, perhaps by changing goals or services. It's important for the parents to believe that the team has developed a thoughtful and well-established plan in the IEP. There should be some discussion of the unique circumstances and how the goals are going to be appropriately ambitious in the development of the FAPE offer. In the Ender F. ruling, Chief Justice Roberts of the Supreme Court stated, when all is said and done, a student offered an educational program providing merely more than de minimis progress from year to year can hardly be said to have been offered an education at all. So the takeaway is consider the child's unique circumstances and develop an IEP that is appropriately ambitious. No matter who the child is or what the circumstances, that's the standard. So what are some other things we look for in an IEP? We start with modifications, and I'm going to give you the definition, and it certainly should be something you're aware of. Modifications are changes to what your child is taught or expected to do in school. Modifications aren't the same as accommodations, which are changes to how your child learns. Only students with an IEP or 504 plan can have modifications. So when we talk about changes to the program, that may be modified schoolwork, maybe picking out the most important salient points for your child. Those are modifications. Accommodations are individualized accommodations that are put in place to help learners at risk and students with special needs to have success in their IEP or academic program. Typically, accommodations are listed in the student's IEP, and accommodations are extended time, potentially testing in a separate setting, being seated at the front of the class. Those are some examples. Neither of the list are exhaustive. There are many, many accommodations and many modifications. Parents should be familiar with what those are before going into the IEP, or at least have a discussion at the IEP. There is no one-size-fits-all in either of these areas. So then we move to the area of related services, and those are services that enable the child to benefit from special education, for example, speech, occupational therapy. So how do you determine what your child's related service needs will be? It's the IEP team's responsibility to review all of the evaluation information, to identify any related services the child needs, and to include them in the IEP. Goals can be written for a related service just as they are for other special education services. There can be a speech goal, an occupational therapy goal. For example, the IEP must also specify with respect to each service when the service will begin, how often it will be provided, and for what amount of time, and where it will be provided. Each child with a disability doesn't require all of the related services that are possible. Again, there's not an exhaustive list. It's important that we talk about services that are required to assist a child with a disability to benefit from special education. So what is the IEP? The IEP is a written commitment for the delivery of service to meet a student's educational needs. A school district needs to ensure that all of the related services specified in the IEP, including the amount, are provided to a student. Changes in the amount of services listed in the IEP cannot be made without holding another IEP meeting. However, if there is no change in the overall amount of service, some adjustments in the scheduling of services may be possible without the necessity of another meeting, and that's usually by written agreement. So, what do we do if parents don't agree? The IEP, as written, with very few exceptions, goes into effect in 10 days unless you file for due process and or request mediation. The stay put in mediation is only through the date of the mediation. This requires that you be knowledgeable about these procedures and the law. That's a tall order for parents, and many parents are tired, overwhelmed, and someone told me yesterday, you know, you can't be an expert in everything, when I was flailing about with my technology. And the same goes for parents. They can be parents, they can be advocates, but they can't be charged with knowing every possible aspect of their child's disability and education. It's not everybody can do that. Parents can and do represent themselves in due process hearings. However, the deck is stacked heavily against them. Parents are held to the same standards in participating in the IEP and in a mediation, And by the way, a mediator cannot force an agreement, and we're going to talk about dispute resolution ideas in another podcast, but I just wanted to point that out there. So if you have questions about your child's IEP, your legal rights, and need advice about how to take the next steps, please call or email us at Mickey Moran at the Child and Family Law Center, a division of Grund & Levitt. The phone number is 312-640-0500, or you can email me at mmoran, M-O-R-A-N, at Grund, G-R-U-N-D, law.com. You can also check out our website, which has lots of resources for parents and links at www.lawforchild.com. And stay tuned for upcoming podcasts where I'll be interviewing a child psychologist, a child psychiatrist, and talk about restraint and seclusion, as well as due process procedures. And I really look forward to adding to our podcast and keeping you informed along the way about legal issues that impact your child and children. Thank you.